Welcome to Northern Soundings Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. This show, I continue my special series, saluting women and men who helped shape the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
If there's a flood or a fire, I will immediately switch to English and evacuate the building and make sure you're safe. But short of that, I'm going to do what you came here to learn. And if you don't understand, you'll understand more next week.
That's Larry Kaplan, former director of the Alaska Native Language Center. He discusses saving languages at risk of disappearing, as well as how language shapes thought. And Chris Lott is in with another Cataxic Clippings.
The job of the linguist, like that of the biologist or the botanist, is not to tell us how nature should behave or what its creations should look like, but to describe those creations in all their messy glory and try to figure out what they can teach us about life, the world, and especially in the case of linguistics, the workings of the human mind.
I hope you'll stick around. This summer on Northern Soundings, I'm running a series of recorded interviews I've had with retired University of Alaska Fairbanks scholars, researchers, and leaders. Our discussions take place live every Monday night at the Murray Auditorium on the UAF campus in a series called Down Memory Lane. The series is hosted by UAF Summer Sessions, and my thanks to it for permission to air these conversations. This week, I talk with Dr. Lawrence Kaplan, former director of the Alaska Native Language Center. Larry joined the center as an instructor of linguistics in 1974 and over the years served in many capacities. He's also generated an impressive list of publications. But as you'll hear in this discussion, his focus, and that of the Language Center, is locked on a critical mission of keeping Alaska Native languages alive in an age of mass media and globalization. That mission is also meeting stiff challenges in the current funding environment. I began our discussion by asking Larry whether his parents were multilingual.
I grew up in a very multilingual situation. The part of Los Angeles where I started out life was had a lot of Spanish speakers. They were Mexican immigrants and children of immigrants, and a lot of the kids spoke Spanish at home. And then my mother and her mother spoke Greek. My father and his brother spoke a fair amount of Yiddish. And so all in all, there were languages. And I thought everybody was like that, because that's how kids are. They think, you know, everybody has what they have. And that got me interested. And then when I was a young, I must have been about 7 years old, my mother sent me to Cub Scouts. And I think she wanted me out of the house a couple of days a week. But that didn't really take very well. So in desperation, she signed me up for French lessons. And that worked. And I really liked that. And we had...
Do you remember that moment when it sort of like, whoa, this is exciting, this is fun, or anything?
Yeah, I'm not sure there was a moment, but I got more and more interested in it. It just seemed like a really interesting thing to do, and I thought it would be nice to know French and maybe other languages too. So that kind of got me started.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now, besides being... a rich family linguistically, I understand they were very progressive and politically engaged.
They were, yeah. I remember as a really young child going to ban the bomb demonstrations in the 50s. My mother had something against nuclear war, if you can imagine.
Yeah, go figure.
Yeah, well, what was she thinking? But anyway, so we would do those things. And then when I was... in high school, there was the Vietnam War, and I remember my mother and her friend took us to a demonstration when Lyndon Johnson came to town, and there was a big demonstration, and some of my friends were envious. They said my parents wouldn't go with me, but there we were. So yeah, we had that at home.
Well, when you went over to France to study. It was still a pretty active time period, politically engaged. Do you have any memories from your studies in France?
When I first arrived in France, it was June of 1968. And some of you may know that was just the end of the big uprisings in France, where the student uprisings, where, I don't know, the students thought they were making the revolution and taking over the government, and they had some unions joining them and so forth. And finally, all of that calmed down. But when I arrived in Paris, they were cleaning the trash out of the streets because nobody'd been picking it up. The country wasn't functioning. And they were tarring over the cobblestones in the streets so that people couldn't pull them up and build barricades. And it was a, you know, it was an exciting time.
Oh, it sounds like it. No yellow vest, but it sounds like
no
it.
Yellow vest.
Yeah, a pretty engaged period of time. Now, I remember when I heard Christopher Isherwood talk, and he said at one point when he was learning German and living in Germany, there was a point where he realized that just everyday objects, when he thought of them in German, were not quite the same objects when he spoke of them in English. Did you have a point like that with French or with any other language?
Sort of, but it was with Inupiaq, because for French, I mean, that's a European language, and for me, the culture and the language were not all that different from English, because French is related to English. It's an Indo-European language. But once I started in on Inupiaq, then that was a whole different language, different grammar, different sounds, and that's what really interested me. But we're getting there, I guess.
It might as well jump there now, in a way. France, Inupiaq. So, how did that work?
I did an undergraduate degree in French, as you said, because that ended up being the easiest way for me to graduate after I'd spent a year collecting credits in France. So, okay, it was time for me to graduate. But then if you continued on in French, if I were to do that, then you're studying literature. And that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to do the language. And so I talked to people about this and said, what do I do? And they said, oh, you want to study actual language and grammar? That's linguistics. It's not, you know, Spanish or French or English or something. And so I applied to graduate school in linguistics with the encouragement of an old family friend, Victoria Fromkin, who is quite a famous person in the field of linguistics, a psycholinguist from UCLA. And I ended up going to University of California, San Diego, and that's where I met Inupiaq.
San Diego is a place you normally would encounter Inupiaq.
Well, you can say that again, but here's what happened. I had my dissertation advisor, my graduate advisor was Margaret Langdon, who was an anthropological linguist. And the department I was in was very theoretical, but we can talk about that at some point. But she had a field methods class where she found an Inupiaq person. And here's how a field methods class works. You find a speaker of a language that nobody in the class knows, and then you ask them questions and try to figure out what you can about how the language works, how the grammar of the language works. And so she found an Inupiaq person in San Diego who was from Utqiagvik, formerly Barrow, and had married a naval person who they ended up in San Diego, where a lot of Navy people go. And so she would come to class a couple of times a week and was so kind and patient with us graduate students who would ask her all sorts of questions. You know, how do you say this? The idea is, you know, so you say, how do you say my mother took my sister to the store? And then she says it, and then you try to figure out, now, which part is mother, which part is sister, which part is store, where's the took? And you try to analyze it, and then you get another question, my grandmother took my brother to the store, and then you can compare the two and sort of, you know, sort of like a puzzle, which appealed to me. And then you figure out which parts mean what, and we were forbidden to read published material about the language. We were to figure this all out on our own and figure out what the sounds are. And because the sounds are different from English, of course.
Yeah.
And so it was really fun, and it appealed to me. And when the class was over, my dear advisor found some funds for me to continue my work with Edith Roray, the aunt of Eileen McLean, if you know the McLean house here on campus. And so I would work with Edith every week. And
you made the connection about the same time with the center here, right?
After about a year and a half, a position opened up here at UAF, and I applied for it.
Had you heard about it before then, Larry?
I'd heard about it because we'd looked at their work, the work they'd done in Yupiaq. And I remember when we finally started reading about the language, we read about the writing system. And they had made a change in the writing system with a meeting here at UAF where in the old system, they wrote a K with a dot under it, and that got changed to a Q to fit with the other Inuit languages across the Arctic. And so, yes, I had heard about it and got interested in what they were doing because it wasn't like what my linguistics department was doing, and that wasn't bad.
This is Northern Soundings, and I'm talking with linguist and former director of the Alaska Native Language Center, Larry Kaplan. When we return from the break, capturing a spoken language on the page. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This summer I'm airing recorded discussions I host as part of a UAF Summer Sessions event called Down Memory Lane. This week I'm speaking with former Alaska Native Language Center Director Larry Kaplan. Let's return to the conversation.
You talked about how you actually set down a language that may not have its own written tradition. How do you decide on that? I mean, are there international conventions about what certain sounds capture them by?
Yes and no. There are international conventions, but the people who make the writing systems don't always follow them. Let's see. The first people who started writing Alaskan and Inupiaq were missionaries. Mm-hmm. Don Webster was a missionary in Barrow, and he worked with an Inupiaq man called Roy Amarowak, who was a minister there from the Presbyterian Church, and they translated the New Testament and before that, Eugene Nida, another linguist, worked on the writing system, and they came up with a series of symbols to represent the sounds. They got the sounds right. Some of the symbols weren't the most felicitous, but they had, you know, developed that writing system. And I didn't develop the writing system. I helped adapt it to other dialects of Alaskan and Inupiaq, I would say.
So someone from Atlanta and someone from Brooklyn and someone from Duluth, for example, all have their own ways of pronouncing English. How do you capture precisely a particular region's pronunciation of a language?
It's hard to imagine that because we have this very standardized writing in English where we all write almost the same, whether you're from, I mean, England has a few little differences and so forth, but they don't really capture the dialect differences that you'd find. But the Inupiaq writing system is very phonemic. That means you're supposed to write the sounds that you're actually saying. So you're writing your own dialect, which has good and bad. You don't have a standard system that can be used by everybody, but at the same time, you're capturing the dialect differences and you're writing something that works for you. So comparing it to English, there are all these people in New York and Boston who say New York, but they write an R. They don't pronounce it, but they have to write it. And they don't object, not that I've heard. But if they were working in a language like an Alaska Native language, they'd probably represent their own pronunciation with the writing.
And when these... Is it called orthography when you come up with a script to describe?
Orthography is the writing system. It's the particular alphabet, the writing system that's used for a particular language.
Now, I'm guessing professionals and scholars like you have a certain expectation on what that would look like. Native speakers who just want a text, you mentioned translating the Bible. Would they use the same orthography on the Bible that they would in your scholarly papers and whatnot?
Oh, okay. In scholarly papers, we also have the International Phonetic writing system. And I should have mentioned that the IPA, International Phonetic Alphabet, which allows phoneticians, linguists, to capture the sounds of any language. And if somebody comes up with a sound that is not in the writing system, well, then it gets added. And people do that periodically, like some of the clicks from Africa. They've come up with some really far out ones that nobody knew existed. Mm. And so they have to add symbols. So linguists do that, and in our scholarly papers, sometimes we use phonetic writing, and sometimes we use the local writing system.
Oh, interesting.
It depends, yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned early missionaries were the first to try to capture a language, set it down for various uses. How has that changed in your experience?
Are there changes in the writing?
Yeah, I mean, do you make, you know, you say, well, you know, that funny squibble there, that shouldn't be there. That, you know, you got to put that over there.
Yes, so, occasionally, I should never admit this, linguists realize that they didn't hear a word right because they're listening to something very subtle and very different, and then they may respell something.
Okay.
And then the speakers of the language also have their way of writing, and that's not always the same as the linguist's way of writing. So that can be a little tricky as well.
Well, I know the center has worked very hard to bring in the actual speakers to be part of that process. Did that alter in your time frame?
Yeah, although, see, that goes back to the 1930s, and Franz Boas, the father of American anthropology, as he's been called, who worked quite a bit with indigenous languages, and then his student Edward Sapir and others who worked on native languages and worked with the speakers and had a great deal of respect for them. They didn't just treat them as informants, but as participants. And that's something that we were doing in Alaska here very early on. That was Michael Krause's conception of the Alaska Native Language Center, and that's part of what attracted me because, as I mentioned earlier, my own graduate department was very theoretically oriented.
And what does that mean when you say it's theoretically oriented?
Okay, there was a revolution in linguistics and starting around 1960. Some of you have heard the name Noam Chomsky, and he came up with a new paradigm for linguistics, and people got very excited. It was a new way of looking at grammar and how sentences come out of our mouth, what goes into it before then, and just what the mental grammar consists of. And then he talked about language acquisition, how children learn languages and what the process is. And people got very excited about this, and MIT in Boston, when Cambridge was the center for all of this. And in my department, there were many professors from who had been educated at MIT, and so some of them fancied us to be MIT West. But that wasn't what I was interested in. I wanted to work with languages and speakers of languages. And I was more interested in anthropological linguistics, which Michael Krause called a breath of stale air, because it came out of the 30s, right? And then it got into this whole Chomsky and theoretical linguistics. Mm-hmm. You know, that became very important to me, and that is really the way what I was interested in language. And applied linguistics, which means you do something that's useful to the general population, and particularly to the native population, who wants dictionaries, teaching materials, typically.
Sure. Okay, well, before we go to your work here, I've heard of the, is it the Sapir-Whorf?
Sapir. Sapir-Whorf hypothesis.
Yeah, and the hypothesis is that a language actually forms the way we view the world. Is that still a viable hypothesis?
It won't die. people keep talking about it.
It's like
it.
Friday the 13th, right? Yeah.
the zombie hypothesis. But it's actually very interesting because it wasn't really proposed by Sapir or Whorf. Many of their ideas went into this theory, which is called linguistic relativism. As I say, people keep talking about it. Well, first thing, there are two forms of the hypothesis. The weak form says that the language we speak influences our perception of the world around us. And the strong form says the language we speak controls, decides how we perceive the world around us. And I don't know that too many scholars adhere to that strong form. And what this refers to is, okay, if you look at Athabascan languages, if I say I pick up this bottle, I have to describe the shape of the bottle. And it's different than I pick up this paper. It's not the same verb to pick up. The verb reflects what you're picking up. Even in Japanese, if I'm counting sheets of paper, if I'm counting people, if I'm counting pencils, there's a grammatical difference. It's not just five of these and five of those, like in English. There are these counters that are different. So does this influence the way speakers of these different languages perceive the world around them? If you have to use a different verb to pick something up versus something else, do you perceive it as something different versus English speakers who see it's all the same stuff, we just use the same number? So that's the discussion, and it's rather hard to prove. And where linguists and anthropologists went with this is studying color terms in different languages, because different languages have very different color terms. And so take Inupiaq, the basic terms are black, white, and red, and probably also green, which also includes blue. And this is a complicated study that many linguists have done. Is blue part of green? Is green part of blue? Is orange part of red? Because for some people in some languages it is. So then the question is, do the speakers of these languages actually see the colors differently than speakers of languages which distinguish between pink and orange and red?
That's fascinating.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. If you're just joining us, I'm airing a recording of a public conversation I had last week with former director of the Alaska Native Language Center, Larry Kaplan. It's part of a UAF summer session series called Down Memory Lane. When we return from the break, mass media and the assault on Indigenous language. Welcome back to Northern Soundings. This week I'm speaking with Larry Kaplan, former director of UAF's Alaska Native Language Center. Let's get back to the discussion.
Looking through your extensive list of publications and articles and whatnot, it seems evenly divided between more academically oriented pieces and more culturally based writings. So how do you approach a project?
Well, what's been done so far, what's been written on the subject, sometimes it's an applied project. What would a particular community be interested in having me do? And sometimes I get invited to do something. I've been asked to write a grammatical sketch of Inupiaq and of Yupik. So sometimes it's often what people are asking for. Mm. Sometimes it's just something I'm interested in.
Okay, and oftentimes I hear we're a storytelling species. And how intimately do stories of a people, are they reflected in the language and vice versa?
Stories are very interesting for a lot of different reasons, including linguistically. Often you get a style of speech that you don't get in everyday language. And of course, it's that way in English too. If you read a published story, it doesn't sound like just what you hear on the street. It's maybe a different type of English, and it's very much that way for native languages. And some of them have particularly ritualistic language that goes into the story. Sometimes there are magical incantations even, and we have that too, fee-fi-fo-fum and all of that sort of thing. And so that's an important part of the language to look at too, I would say.
Yeah. Who was here when you, of course, Michael, of course, you've referenced, but other people that were here when you first joined the department?
James Carey, Athabascan linguist, working on Dena'ina, the language of the Anchorage area, Cook Inlet, working on Atna, Copper River language, and other languages. he had been hired a year or two before me. Stephen Jacobson was working on Yupik, and some of you know him. He's produced a number of interesting dictionaries. Edna McLean was here. She was the Inupiaq instructor. Very interesting person, native speaker of the Inupiaq language from Utqiagvik, who has taken it quite far, got a PhD at Stanford working with Inupiaq narratives and stories. And so it was an interesting team.
Yeah.
And others too, Eliza Jones, a co-author of the Koyukon Athabaskan Dictionary, Catherine Peter, grandmother of our Vice Chancellor Yvonne Peter, working on her Gwich'in Athabaskan language. And
touching on this, I hear that we lose languages at a quite rapid pace. Is that true? And how are we doing in that regard here in Alaska, Larry?
Well, it's a very dramatic situation, the situation of language loss. And I think it's been estimated that by the end of this century, half the world's languages will be gone, because these are small languages that are getting overpowered by big languages. And you can well imagine how this happens. I mean, it's happening around us here in Alaska with television, with education, with jet travel. English becomes more important, and little languages become harder to maintain. And then on top of that, there's been propaganda in favor of English, telling people that they really should not teach their language to their children. They should teach English, because that local language isn't going to get them very far. And many of the first people who encountered the native languages didn't understand that these were full systems of communication, like English or French. They were thinking that if you have leather-bound published volumes in your language, that's good. And if it's an oral language that's spoken by a group of people, that's not so good. So they had these misunderstandings, I would say. Ethnocentrism on top of it, favoring European languages over indigenous languages. So children were punished in schools, and in various ways the native languages were discouraged. And so the result today is that a lot of the native languages in North America are getting overwhelmed by English, and in other parts of the world by other world languages. And so it's quite a dramatic situation, because we're here with what may be the last speakers of some of the languages, or the last fluent speakers. And even from when I came in the 70s, I had access to extremely fluent elders with deep, deep cultural and linguistic knowledge of their language, who knew their own language way better than English. And now that's changed. By now, those elders are no longer with us, and people speak more English and are conscious of the importance of revitalizing the native languages. And so the young people have taken up the cudgels, and they are very interested in seeing the languages maintained, brought back, revitalized. And so that's a lot of what's going on now in Alaska for in the language movement. And one of the big movements that everybody looks to is Hawaiian.
And why is that?
Well, the Hawaiians have very, very good results with their language revitalization program. They modeled some of what they did on New Zealand. The Maori people in New Zealand started these language nests called kohangareo, and where they took little children, and if you take a little child who's 2 years old or whatever, they'll learn whatever language you speak to them in. That's why we have so many languages in the world. So they put native speakers of Maori there to spend whatever portion of the day with these children. And that worked out quite well. And then the Hawaiians took that model. They call it punanaleo, again, language nest. I've been to programs there where they take babies in cribs, and they're listening to Hawaiian. And I said, but my God, aren't these children going to learn English? And they said, no, that's not the problem. Are these children going to learn Hawaiian? I don't think anybody's going to grow up in Hawaii today or Alaska and not learn English. That's hard to imagine. But are they going to learn Inupiaq? Are they going to learn Hawaiian? Are they going to learn Tlingit? These are the questions. And they really got that, because in Alaska, some of the elders that I would work with were kind of concerned that their children might not learn English. And I would say, I don't think there's much of a chance of that. So the Hawaiians had these language nests. They have school programs, immersion school programs, where all the subject matter is taught in Hawaiian. The math classes in Hawaiian. These aren't just what are called language classes. It's everything, history, social studies. And then there's an English class too, and they do learn English. And you can now go from kindergarten to a PhD all in the Hawaiian language. So they've accomplished this. The other thing they did is, then I'll stop on Hawaii, but it's so interesting to me. They've gotten some of the young families to use Hawaiian as their home language. Mm. And so they speak to their children in Hawaiian, and the children learn Hawaiian. And do they learn English? Yes, of course they do. But they've done what linguists call, they've restarted the intergenerational transmission. That's how all of us learned our first language, from the older generation, from our parents. And they want to restart that process so the Hawaiian language gets passed on in the traditional way. So they're doing that. And that's kind of the gold standard for language revitalization.
Are we trying to apply some of those techniques here in the state?
Yes, that we have native language immersion schools. There are a number of them that have sprung up. There's quite a good one in Bethel teaching Yupik. And there's an Inupiaq immersion school in Kotzebue, and probably some others. And there are European language immersion schools in Anchorage, actually, that are going very well. And I try to get the native teachers to visit those because they're going so well. But it's a lot easier to teach a European language where there are all these materials that already exist. You know, you open a catalog from some big educational publisher, and you can find how many Spanish books and French books. But you know, try and do that for Holacachuk or something. You're not going to find us. The part of this that's so difficult is it's not easy to transfer one method to another location, because every language situation is different, even within the same language. I mean, if you look at Yupik in Southwest Alaska, the language is faring much better on the lower Kuskokwim River than it is on the lower Yukon River. The lower Yukon children are not learning Yupik at home, and the youngest speakers are up in their, maybe their 60s. Whereas on the Kuskokwim, you still have little children coming to school speaking only Yupik and learning English at school. And then people have studied why the difference, and there are these differences. So it's not easy to, you can compare situations, but they're not the same. And of course, Hawaii and Alaska are very different. Hawaii has one native language with barely any dialect difference, surprisingly. So that makes it kind of easy for them. And sounds that are quote unquote easy to pronounce. That means English speakers don't have a huge problem pronouncing Hawaiian. Whereas if you look at Tlingit, you would not believe the complicated sound system of that language that takes, you know, quite a bit of dedication to learn. So it's all different than the social and historical situations of all these different places. Hawaiian had a very high literacy rate in the early years of the 20th century. People were very literate. The missionaries went, developed a writing system, and taught a lot of people to read and write. And then, you know, in Hawaii had its own kingdom. It was a little country and so forth, whereas Alaska's native people had very different social organizations. So you can compare, but you can't just import. Take this and put it there.
Yeah. Right?
If you're just joining us, I'm airing a recording of a public conversation I had last week with former director of the Alaska Native Language Center, Larry Kaplan. When we return from the break, finding funds to preserve language. Listening to Northern Soundings, I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. This summer, I'm airing a special series of conversations with key UAF scholars, scientists, and administrators. This episode, I'm speaking with the former director of the Alaska Native Language Center, Larry Kaplan. It's part of a UAF summer session series called Down Memory Lane. Let's get back to the discussion.
It seems like much of the center's work over time was to train educators. That must be key, isn't it?
It is. That's the really important, is to get the local people and the local teachers to do the language work. And of course, that's been complicated. One of the efforts in Alaska, there's been a big effort to train local teachers who are from villages, because in the Alaskan villages, there's a high turnover of teachers. They come from outside the state, they stay a year or two, they leave. Not all, but there's a high turnover rate. And you know, there's been a push to get local people trained and educated so that they can teach, and then they're obligated to teach the standard curriculum that is mandated by the State Board of Education. And the native languages aren't on that. And so some of them find time to introduce that, but native language is still an optional subject that's outside of the main curriculum, you know, the three R's and all that sort of thing. So
sure. When you were talking, I was thinking about, I can open a magazine or see all these advertisements for new language apps. There are all these great new skills and approaches to teaching language. How has language pedagogy changed, and are there new techniques on the horizon?
Yeah, well, language pedagogy has changed. And when I started studying language, and some of you too, they used what was called the grammar translation approach, where you'd learn grammar, and you know, people would tell you the rules of the grammar, and you'd do a lot of translation. And that was great to learn grammar and learn translation, but it didn't always help people to speak the language. It was not an oral approach. And then they came up with the audiolingual method, where we'd go to the language lab and put on our headphones and have all these pattern drills. And now people don't think too much of that one. And now, I mean, I think people believe mostly in the direct method, where you use the language with the class, and the more of the language you hear, the more you're gonna get, and you're gonna start to understand. And so, because there are language classes that are taught primarily in English, they talk about the language in English, and that's not as good as one that uses more of the language. And when I've taught language, my students say, "But what if I don't understand you?" And so I tell them this. I say, "If there's a flood or a fire, I will immediately switch to English and evacuate the building and make sure you're safe. But short of that, I'm going to do what you came here to learn. And if you don't understand something, you'll understand more next week and the following week." And that's sort of the way it works. I took a Danish class here from when we had a Danish program, from a very good instructor. And the first day I didn't understand anything, and then gradually I started understanding Danish. And I thought, oh my God, I'm understanding and starting to speak Danish. It kind of works, I mean, you know, but you have to get the students to trust you.
Yeah, big one there.
Yes.
Especially with those fire and earthquake drills. I often think, well, we have all these recordings of people, and so you plug a kid in and they can learn a language through these electronic means. And then there's the much more existential or human interaction. What I hear you saying is the context for learning a language is best in the social environment.
I would say so, yeah. Learning a language is not about memorization, and it's kind of a mysterious process, because I think of it like learning to play the piano or something. Mm. You know, eventually it becomes automatic, and you're looking at the notes and they're flowing through your mind and out your fingers, and you're doing it. And you're not going, "Now I play a C, now I play an E." That's not how it works.
That's not how
and
it
the
works.
Same with speaking a language. You don't, you know, people think you're translating from your own first language. That's not what it is at all. It becomes an automatic process, in other words. And that's what a language class should be trying to achieve, is helping students to make it, to internalize the language and make it into something automatic. As far as you asked about the technology, and I didn't answer that one. So there's access to a lot of material on the internet. You know, you can learn all kinds of languages on the internet, and some of the techniques seem pretty good and some not so good. I was using Duolingo to try to prepare me to go to Norway, and I thought it was pretty good. It helps to know some of the language. That's, for me, the best is you get started on a language, so then you're not hearing something totally foreign, you're hearing something a little foreign, but you can figure it out. You've got a leg up, whereas you just start cold. That I'd rather do in a classroom.
You compared it to music, and I've often heard language compared to mathematics, for example, in that if you're exposed and engaged early on, you have a greater facility. Do you think there's truth to that?
Oh, okay. That is called the critical age hypothesis, which says that before puberty, you can learn a language as your native language, and then you sound like, you know, you grew up there speaking it, whatever the language is. And then after puberty, you're going to have a foreign accent and some grammatical mistakes. But is it true? That's the question. And I don't know. There's a lot of research on this that's not always entirely conclusive.
Well, your mind must be flexible enough. Like you were saying, you were just picking up Danish at some point. So your mind must have certain pathways set down in the synapses where you can see the patterns.
I think you're right. And that's the thing people say, well, if you've already learned one other language, you know, in addition to your first language, we all have that, but you learned one second language, then it's easier to learn another one. Is that true? And in my case, I think it is, just because if you've learned other languages, you know what to do. And then you've conquered the psychological barrier, which is, I can't do this. You can do it. I can't do it. I hear that all the time. And so once you've done it, you go, oh, I guess I can do this. People don't like to make mistakes also, you know, because you end up being reduced to something like a four-year-old. And for some people, that's mortifying.
Yeah, emotionally, I'm pretty much there already, so wouldn't be a big issue for me.
I guess I don't care, make a mistake, I'll talk in baby talk and figure it'll get better.
Well, on the other side of the coin, of course, is for those languages, as you point out during your time, that are dwindling and disappearing, how do you capture what was there, and are there models for successfully reviving a language once lost?
Yes, they're few and far between, but yes, the most famous example is Hebrew in Israel. You could say it was a dead language. It wasn't gone. It was a liturgical language. It was nobody's first language that they learned at home for a long period of time. It was a religious language that people studied, like Latin is for the Catholic Church, or was in any case. They revived that language and turned it into a modern spoken language.
Ireland too attempted that, didn't it? Tried to revive Gaelic as the official
Gaelic
language.
Gaelic is still a spoken language to some extent. Yeah, Irish Gaelic is the example of the declining language that has state support for revitalization. The Irish government would love to, fully revitalize the language, and there's all sorts of efforts made to encourage the use of Irish. So if you can speak Irish, they add points to your test. You get priority over other people. It's seen as a good thing, and it still doesn't necessarily revitalize the language. There are other situations that make it complicated.
Well, as I mentioned early on, you're part of the International PhD School for Studies of Arctic Societies. What's behind that organization?
Oh, that's been a really nice part of my past almost 20 years. There's a consortium of universities that are either in the Arctic or deal with the Arctic, have Arctic traditions of Arctic scholarship. And so faculty representatives have gotten together and put on seminars where we bring in graduate students who work in Arctic social science to present their research and discuss with each other, network with each other, criticize and talk about each other's research and the faculty's research. So that's been quite an interesting undertaking. The last seminar was here at UAF. There was one here in 2006, and then when was it, 2015, I guess it was, a couple of years ago anyway. We had another one. Otherwise, the first one was in Greenland in 2002. That was pretty exciting. And then there was one in Copenhagen, a couple in Canada, and so on. So it really has put some of us here in touch with international scholars of Arctic societies.
Mm-hmm. That must be useful. I want to turn now to your administrative work, because sometimes when you take up the mantle like you did as the director of the center, you encounter challenges that you wouldn't necessarily out in the field or in the classroom. How's the center doing? What were some of the major events and challenges you had to face, Larry?
Well, in a way, it's what all of the University of Alaska has to face now, declining budgets. And, you know, when positions become vacant, they don't necessarily get refilled. And so that's probably the most difficult thing, is that as we lose faculty and some of them retire, like me, then the position may not get refilled. We have less capacity to do what we're supposed to do. And what we're supposed to do was mandated by the state legislature in 1972. They set up the center. Alaska's the only state that has a native language center. There's no New Jersey Native Language Center or Idaho Native Language Center. And why is that? Well, native people in Alaska constitute, by now, about 16 or 17% of the population, so vastly more percentage-wise than any other state, which gives them a fair amount of political clout. You know, that's probably why it is. So, of course, the big challenge I talked about before was the language revitalization and what to do when languages are on the decline.
Sure. I saw, reviewing your publications and whatnot, some are still in process. So are there projects you're working on now, even though you've retired, Larry?
Yeah, that's part of the point of the retirement.
Yeah.
So now, I mentioned earlier, I'm supposed to be writing grammatical sketches of languages, and then there's some dictionaries I want to work on that I've collected material for. I'll mention that just a month ago, I was out in White Mountain, Alaska, near Nome, a little village where they invited me to teach a class, and it was so exciting. I'd done field work there 30 years earlier, and then I was able to go back and teach language and linguistics to a group of interested people, and that was fun. People were so eager and so welcoming, and it didn't hurt that I'd worked with their parents and grandparents, and so it was very rewarding.
Well, I know another one of your passions is classical music, and especially opera. And you mentioned there might be a relationship between piano playing and learning a language. Where did that love of opera come from, and where do you think there's a relationship with your love of music and language?
Well, of course, their operas are in other languages, and I enjoy that, many of them.
And I have to tell you, I have seen plenty of English productions of other language operas, and I still don't understand what they're saying.
I know. It's hard yeah. to understand.
Does your linguistic give you an edge on that?
Maybe. I don't know. I read the titles. That was a big revolution for me when the titles came in, because people used to sit in the opera house with a libretto and a flashlight, right, and follow the text. And so the titles were wonderful. And even a language I know. So I listen to an opera in French. I listen to Carmen. And I know a lot of the words. But still, the titles are very helpful. But for me, I saw a film of La Traviata back in the days when they showed films at Alaska Land, when it was called Alaska Land, and I'd never seen anything so beautiful. It's this film with Franco Zeffirelli production of La Traviata with Placido Domingo and Teresa Stratus, who's an absolute angel, and it was the most beautiful thing I'd seen, and that really got me. And then the next thing was I went to Anchorage and ended up buying a couple of cassettes of Maria Callas. I just thought, I wonder what this is about. And I put those on my headphones, listened through my headphones, and I thought, I didn't know human beings could sing like this. This is incredible. And so that really got me going. And you know, that sort of done it. And then recently I was in New York, saw La Traviata at the Met, again with Placido Domingo, so that was fun. Yeah. Except instead of singing the young tenor, he was singing the grumpy old father and was now singing the baritone part instead of the tenor part. And so, but that was fun. It was great seeing him live in that opera. So yeah, I really enjoy it. And of course, I worked with Opera Fairbanks. I was on the board? For a number of years, working with a really interesting, talented group of people here in Fairbanks. Of course, the local talent in music never ceases to amaze me here. When I try to tell people about it who aren't here, they sort of can't believe just everything that goes on here. But it was so much fun working on those productions and meeting the people local and the people we brought in from singers with the Metropolitan Opera and so forth. And I'll tell you a little story. I was in line for tickets at the Metropolitan Opera one time, and one of the singers we'd had here comes walking by, Richard Bernstein, who some of you know, and I said, "Richard, Richard," and he said, "I'll be right back." So he goes walking off, and I'm talking to the people in line, and the woman next to me is saying, "Well, I'm a psychiatrist at Yale, and I go to the Metropolitan Opera, you know, regularly," and so on. I'm like, "Great, I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska." Oh. And so then Richard Bernstein comes back and talks to me, and these people are going, "You know him?" And then I couldn't talk to him because they were all over him. You know? So it was really funny. Anyway, I think it raised Fairbanks in their estimation. But, and besides that, it's really fun. And our artistic director, Greg Buchalter, is always at the Met, and whenever I go there, I can see him. And so it's really set up, you know, another network of contacts.
Well, as you probably know, a lot of people fear opera is a dying art form and it won't survive very long.
Aging audiences
is
what they were.
Exactly. So trying to translate that for a modern.
I saw an opera at the San Diego Opera that brought in the young people. It was wonderful. It's called Great Scott, and it's Jake Hagee wrote it. And it was delightful, and you know, it appealed to all the generations. So there are new things being done in opera. I love to see the old war horses, but
sure,
there are some interesting new things too.
Well, do you have any other things you're looking forward to in retirement? Places you want to go? Trips?
Oh, are there places I don't want to go? Yeah, I like to travel, and we were just recently in Norway, and that was a really nice trip, and I hope to be able to do more traveling, yeah. Mm. So there's a lot to do.
Well, Larry Kaplan, thank you so much for sharing with us tonight.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Links to UAF Summer Sessions and the UAF Alaska Native Language Center are on the Northern Soundings website. My thanks to Michelle Bartlett and Summer Sessions for permission to air the discussions. When we return from the break, Chris Slott and Cachexia Clippings. Here's Chris and Cachexia Clippings.
In the same way I am not a lawyer, despite inflicting my sometimes sadly earned knowledge of copyright law on students, I am by no measure a linguist of any type, other than the armchair variety, and this despite taking an excellent Intro to Linguistics class from the highly regarded Dr. Kaplan. In my defense, I was rather distracted at the time by extracurricular activities of the sort that find no place on my resume, and I had no idea what linguistics was or what linguists did. I assumed then, as many do today, based on the continued expression of annoyance by linguists who are asked how many languages they speak, that to be a linguist meant being multilingual. And indeed, this is the spirit of the first definition in most dictionaries, such as the OED, which defines a linguist as a person who is skilled in the learning or use of foreign languages, or Merriam-Webster, which describes a linguist as a person accomplished in languages, and notes especially one who speaks several languages. From the Latin lingua, meaning tongue or language, the earliest recorded use of the word linguist dates back to 1582 in a marginal comment in the Douay Rheims Bible mocking those who speak in tongues rather than prophesize, saying they are much like to some fond linguists of our time who think themselves better than a doctor of divinity that is not a linguist. That root lingua is also easily recognizable as a source of various common words today, such as lingo and bilingual, though sadly it is not the source of linger or lingerie, which I embarrassingly pronounced lingerie for way too long, for which folk etymologies would write themselves. The evolution of linguist from synonymous with polyglot to one who studies language, and finally one who works in the field of linguistics, follows the contours of the birth and subsequent evolution of the modern discipline that would emerge 200 years after Douay Rheims' biblical observation. The broad study of language and its history led to philology, including comparative language studies and the recreation of Proto-Indo-European and other early undocumented languages, and ultimately to the plethora of linguistic areas of study and subject of an endless array of pop science articles and books, including historical linguistics, language acquisition, etymology, syntax, morphology, phonology, and so on, right up to the burgeoning field of computational linguistics enabled by advances in both raw computing power and the creation of artificial intelligence systems. At the same time, linguistics has also abandoned most of its formerly prescriptive approach, which was deeply intertwined with colonialist thinking, and shed many grammar pedants along the way, in favor of descriptive pursuits that seek to explain how and why languages exist and function, rather than how someone thinks they should. This is arguably morally sound, but also pragmatic, because as Bill Bryson memorably put it, usage, spelling, and pronunciation tend to wander around like hemlines. Thus, modern linguistic studies includes everything from fascinating explorations of internet language, emoji, and memes, to explaining the complete nature and grammar of American Sign Language and the structure of dialects that have been wrongly dismissed as incomplete, including African-American vernacular English. As Anita Okrent put it in her book Invented Languages, which explores intentionally created languages from Esperanto, Klingon, and Elvish to Bliss Symbolics and Loglan, the job of the linguist, like that of the biologist or the botanist, is not to tell us how nature should behave or what its creations should look like, but to describe those creations in all their messy glory and try to figure out what they can teach us about life, the world, and especially in the case of linguistics, the workings of the human mind. But this is easier said than done, given that messy glory. Perhaps language and lingerie, and thus linguistics, are related after all, not etymologically, but in their shared function of concealing and revealing at once. None other than Ludwig Wittgenstein noted this paradox in one of the few parts of his Tractatus I can claim to understand, when he wrote, "Language disguises thought so that one cannot infer, from the outward form of the clothing, the form of the thought clothed by it." The pursuit of the scientific understanding of language will always exist in a taut relationship with language as a means of artistic expression and the ineffable aspects of communication. The science and romance of language are lovers who just can't quit one another, even though the relationship both nourishes and diminishes them. Because for each example of, as Orwell said and demonstrated in 1984, thought corrupting language and language corrupting thought, a dynamic never as clear as it is today in our sharply polarized conversations that are both a bane to our culture and a gift to linguists, there is also the eternal hope that through language we can reach beyond ourselves and even beyond connection to others, to something pure and beautiful. Flaubert put this hope best in his, spoiler alert, tragic novel, Madame Bovary, when he wrote, "Human speech is like a cracked kettle on which we tap crude rhythms for bears to dance to, while we long to make music that will melt the stars." For more on linguists and language, including bits about lingua franca for the brain and linguini for the stomach, or to read and listen to this or any other Cathexic Word segment, point your favorite browser to cathexic.com/KUAC.
That's it for this Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. We'll see you next week when I talk with Pete Penny about the connection between service and scholarship. Thanks for listening.